Over at AIPAC, the leaders of the Israel lobby in Washington, D.C., they're constantly proclaiming unrivaled influence on Capitol Hill, and they should be proud. The NRA and AARP's efforts make them look like puppy dogs in comparison to the campaigns of intimidation regularly run by the neoconservatives and Israel firsters against their political enemies. But the Israel lobby does not remain unopposed. At the Council for the National Interest, they put America first, insisting on an end to the empire's unjustified support for Israel's aggression against its neighbors and those whose land it occupies, and pushing back against the lobby's determined campaign in favor of U.S. attacks against Israel's enemies. CNI also does groundbreaking work on the trouble with evangelical Christian Zionism and neocon-engineered Islamophobia and drumming up support for this costly and counterproductive policy. Please help support the efforts of the Council for the National Interest to create a peaceful, pro-American foreign policy. Just go to councilforthenationalinterest.org and click Donate under About Us at the top of the page. And thanks.
All right, y'all. I got him. Boy, this is going to cost an arm and a leg on the cell phone, but oh well. Hey, Pepe, how the hell are you, man? Welcome to the show.
Hey, man, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Boy, it was funny. I called that the first number that you gave me there, and I got fax machine noises. I got a lady in a foreign language screaming at me. I got some hippie telling me you got the wrong number, man. You got to try again later. And
welcome
I got a busy
Asia.
Signal. It was never the same error twice. But anyway, I got you on the phone.
Okay, man.
All right.
Good to talk to you, as usual.
Yes, I'm very happy to have you here. Everybody, you know Pepe. He writes for the Asia Times. And he's the author of the book, Obama Does Globalist Stand. Which is
that
kind of a strange name for a book.
Ago.
But anyway. Yeah. It's about the American empire. Okay, so you got this thing, the last one I read anyway, I'm sorry if this is not your latest piece, but the latest one that I read is called Meet the Friends of Jihad, about the American
right.
war in Syria, about the failure of the American war in Syria at this point. Is it too soon for Assad to go like this?
No, remember, Scott, we've been talking about this for almost 2 years now, and every time... That was the same thing. The whole system was relatively in place. He's not going to fall the next day or the next week. Like if you're reading the New York Times, for instance, it will always be next day or next week. No major defection. Business class is still supporting him. And then when some gangs of the Free Syrian Army, when they actually start taking places, and controlling some regions or some suburbs, or in the case of Aleppo, in fact, two suburbs, and people saw the way they were behaving, they were absolutely appalled, repelled,
yeah.
disgusted. And it was obvious. And, of course, when Syrians themselves saw that they were in the middle of the crossfire in this absolutely ghastly proxy war, and they start to see by themselves that people on the ground, the fighters on the ground, that were really doing the heavy fighting were the jihadis crossing the border from Iraq or from, you know, the multinational mercenaries paid by Saudi Arabia and Qatar. It's inevitable. And they were fighting an organized army. The Syrian army may not be exactly spectacular in terms of, for instance, responding to Israel, for that matter, or trying to recapture the Golan Heights, you know. But in terms of a well-organized army for Middle East standards, that's what they are. And to win against this army, you would need a very well-organized guerrilla Vietnam style. It's not going to happen, not with this bunch in Syria. So, you know, the result was inevitable. So what happened in Qusair, in fact, this is my last story, which was published yesterday, in fact, after the one you read, Meet the Friends of Jihad, which is, by the way, for everybody knows already, it's the NATO-GCC-Israel axis. The story in Qusair, which is an absolutely strategic point for months, it's the chronicle of a death foretold for people who are still inside Qusair. The Syrian army, they saw that they needed to retake Qusair because it's very close to Homs and it was about 10 kilometers from the Lebanese border. So the supplies for the jihadis in that area and in the Homs Hama corridor that goes in a highway that goes parallel, more or less 3 or 4 kilometers outside of Qusair, going north-south from Damascus to Aleppo. They needed to retake that place. It was absolutely strategic. It was controlled by one really hardcore Free Syrian Army brigade. So what did they do? They went there. They more or less encircled the city. The Free Syrian Army, they made a call for another brigade in Aleppo to go south to help them. The Syrian Army said, okay, let's make these guys go. They cross our, we just, you know, don't do anything for the moment. And then we encircle both brigades inside Qusair. This whole thing took more or less 6 months, the past 6 months. And the real heavy fighting started, 3 weeks ago, sort of, more or less. And that's exactly what happened. You know, it was very intelligent. They had help, of course, we all know that, from Hezbollah fighters. Not many. 150, according to my best estimates from people I talked to in Beirut. And Iranians, not many as well, 50 or 60, but with experience where? In the Iran-Iraq war. Come on. So these guys know everything about urban warfare.
And meanwhile, the guys that they're fighting are going, and firing their AK-47 in the air, but they don't have any idea what to do.
Exactly, because these two brigades, and we're talking about the two best Free Syrian Army brigades, the Al-Faruq, which was in control of Qusair for the past few months, over a year, in fact, and the Al-Tawid brigade, which was in Aleppo. And can you imagine these guys were overrun. Can you imagine the rest of this bunch of mercenaries, you know, which are getting a lot of very good weapons, a lot of money, but most of them, they really have no fighting experience. These
right.
two
I
brigades,
mean, and, you
they
know,
have
it's
people
true.
Who fought in Iraq.
If you look at Somalia, for example, really
yeah.
believing in what you're doing counts for a lot. Not being afraid to die on the battlefield counts for a lot, for sure. That's why you have the al-Nusra Front out in front, and you have the so-called moderates are hanging out back at the base, hoping everything works out for them or whatever. But it still is no match for actual professional military strategy, certainly not when you're talking about a government in its own country, right? I mean, we're not talking about the American occupation of Iraq here. We're talking about the Ba'athist occupation of Syria.
Exactly. Absolutely. So, you know, this was the end. It was very interesting because more or less 6 months ago, I start noticing something from the point of view of, you know, people in Damascus, businessmen in Damascus, businessmen in Aleppo, average Syrians, or Syrians who managed to flee to go to Europe. They start talking a lot about the army was pissed. The fact that they were being derided, and a lot of people are saying that they were not doing their jobs properly. So that's when they start to get their act together, finally. And all those defections that were being advertised in the West, they never happened anyway. Well, a few. But we're not talking about major, you know, generals and people who really know about warfare. They were still there. And they said, okay, let's organize, let's see what these people are, these brigades are, let's identify their weakness, and let's organize an overall strategy. First in Damascus, remember, they secured Damascus, and we haven't heard about car bombings in Damascus anymore. So it's working for the past few months. And then let's go to the Hama Homs corridor, where Qusair is, and the next step is going through Aleppo, and this is exactly what they're doing as we speak. So the next step is be to clear the suburbs of Aleppo. So it is a concerted military strategy. You know, it's no joke. It's no joke at all. It took a while for them to organize themselves. And it's a matter of national pride for the Syrian army. You know, they say, look, it's our job to protect the country. We know what these people are doing to the country. It's the foreigners, of course. Of course, there are Syrians in all these Syrian brigades. But it's more or less 50-50, in fact. And if you look at the numbers, the overall numbers, let's say there are 20,000 fighters all over Syria against the government. No, probably not more than that. You have at least 10,000 foreigners, which is completely absurd. It is an army of half army of mercenaries.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, this same kind of thing happened in Iraq too, like you mentioned, where whenever the al-Nusra Front guys or their acolytes have taken hold of an area, they make enemies out of the local population immediately with their would-be totalitarianism. And the same thing happens with al-Qaeda guys wherever they are. People hate their guts because they're jerks. So, I mean, they don't have a future anywhere, really, unless America just keeps creating battlefields for them to fight in. But assuming that peace breaks out anywhere, no one's going to tolerate their rule anywhere.
It's more or less like what happened in what was happening in Iraq before the beginning of the surge, when at the time Al Qaeda in Iraq, they took some neighborhoods, the entire neighborhoods like Dora in southern Baghdad, and then the local people started to organize themselves and call for help to expel those people from over there. Yeah. Because it's the usual thing in terms of the al-Qaeda in Iraq, al-Nusra, is the same old story. It's Sharia law hardcore, banning women from everywhere, beheading people, you name it. And in that famous YouTube video of the guy eating the lungs of a Syrian soldier, you know, that speaks for itself.
And hey, listen, man, I was talking with our friend David Enders from McClatchy Newspapers about that, and he said, well, you know, that guy is from the Al-Farouk Brigade. They're the moderates who won elections, right?
Exactly.
They're the guys who are at loggerheads with the al-Nusra Front about whether they should just outright name their favorite imam dictator or whether they should vote for him first.
In fact, it's a mirror image, jihadi style, of the Syrian National Council, who, you know, every week they have a leader, the guy, you know, resigns once or twice. They say, look, I'm resigning again. So they have to appoint another one. They have to change the name. So they go to Doha for another meeting. It's the same shit.
Man, well, so... Didn't anybody at the CIA warn Obama that this isn't going to work? You know, it's like the Bay of Pigs, basically, right? You send in enough guys and enough guns to lose. What is the point?
Yes, exactly.
You know?
In fact, this is a slow-motion Bay of Pigs, in fact.
It's horrible. I mean, you know, and here's the thing, too, and this doesn't get said enough probably in these interviews because, of course, my interest is in contradicting the rationalization for American intervention as best as possible. But it's important to note that all good people in the world hate Assad's guts. He runs a totalitarian police state. And 2 years ago, well, 2.5 years ago, when this thing started, it was a lot of regular, decent, peaceful people. Maybe even some of the violent ones were still decent and just wanted to be free. And the problem is it's the true believers that really keep fighting and that take the forefront and happen to turn out to be the suicide bomber, prisoner beheader, heart eater, lunatics. And so anybody who was a well-meaning dissenter who just wanted rid of Ba'athism and some semblance of self-government, however you can get some in Syria, those people all had to go back inside. And they don't have anything to do with what's going on now, very little anyway.
Exactly, and it's very interesting how, especially in urbanized Syria, these past few months, how it changed, you know, the mood in terms of public opinion, how it changed drastically against this motley crew of jihadis, opportunists, sort of defectors, mercenaries, you name it, you know. So this is something that I mentioned in one of these stories, probably the one you read, in fact. There was relief organizations. They made an informal poll with maybe 2,000 people. They say, look, it's informal. But the results are stark. You know, 70%, they are totally against the so-called opposition Syrian National Council, whatever you mean it. And 20% only are in favor and 10% are neutral. They sent this report to NATO. It was collected by relief organizations and human rights organizations, not the Syrian Observatory of Human Rights, because they are not even inside Syria. It's the one guy in London paid by the Emirati. It's completely ridiculous. People are actually doing a relief work inside Syria. They sent this report to NATO, and NATO obviously never publicized. If you go to NATO website, it's not there. So this tells you something that was brewing for the past few months, especially, you know, there are a lot of Syrians in Brazil who have family in Syria, in Argentina as well. So, you know, so they keep getting feedback from their families in different areas of the country. And over the past few months, you could see that, you know, the mood was changing. People, they knew that they were in the middle of a proxy war. They knew that the alternatives were absolutely ghastly on both sides.
Yeah.
So they just want the war to end. And the only mechanism in existence is elections for next year. Don't forget there are elections in Syria in 2014, according to the Constitution. So it would be a ceasefire now. Which is something, this is something that the U.S. and the Russians should negotiate if the Geneva II talks happen. It's not going to be in June anymore, probably in July, if they happen, right?
Well, so America can't really promise anything to the Russians other than we'll stop arming them, but they sure as hell can't command their shock troops to quit.
No, they can't, and they won't, and they don't want it, by the way. Because don't forget that from the point of view of Israel, especially, the current status quo, which is a protracted civil war, is very good for them.
Yeah.
Because it pins down the Syrian army inside Syria. Syria is weak. The country is being devastated by the war. So it's very good from an Israeli point of view. From an American point of view, as long as there are no American targets, you know, it's good for them. They're leading from behind. They don't care. So this could go on for years, in fact. The problem is that now that the Syrian army is, you know, in control of the whole thing, and they could eventually, I would say, throw these bombs in the middle of the desert within the next 2 or 3 months. Let's say if this happens, What is the solution from a Washington, Paris, London point of view? Weaponize these guys. This is already what they're saying.
Yeah.
This is what the Brits got out of the European Union, in fact. In fact, that bunch of coward European Union nations, apart from Britain, they just let the ban against arming the rebels expire. So now the Brits, this is what they're going
to do. You
mean
heavy weapons?
This summer.
You mean real explosives.
Exactly.
As opposed to just machine guns.
It's an essentially British-French operation inside the European Union. It's absolutely ghastly as well, you know. So they start re-weaponizing the rebels, then we have a Lebanese 1970s situation. This thing will go on forever.
Yeah. Well, that's the quote from McCain from just the other day, is that Assad is winning, and we got to prevent him from winning. He's not really saying we got to make sure that al-Nusra wins. We just got to prevent Assad from winning, basically. And
absolutely. So this is the McCain way of saying we want civil war for as long as it takes.
Although, here's the thing, too, though, and, you know, I'm sure you probably saw this thing. It's the ultimate Patrick Coburn treatment of this subject in the London Review of Books, where he basically says the same thing as you on so much of this stuff. And one of the things that he emphasizes is that the so-called Free Syrian Army and the different kinds of jihadists, they're real good with the YouTube, and the Baathists are not. And so you could have, in other words, a bunch of know-nothing know-it-alls in D.C. go, wow, look, another officer defected or something. But they don't see the footage of all the officers who stayed loyal because the Baathists don't have their act together enough to make a YouTube of that and put that out there.
Exactly.
And so they kind of believe their own BS. So in other words, I guess my question is, you really think that's possible? It sounds plausible to me that the Baathists could actually just simply win this thing and wrap this thing up. As you said, what percentage of the fighters are actually not even from Syria? Half of them?
Half of them, at least. Half of them, at least. Yeah. This means that there is a hardcore nucleus of jihadis, which it's debatable. It could be 300, 500, or 1,000. And the, let's say, the regular militias, which are, we call them the Free Syrian, maybe the not-so-free Syrian army, or the fee Syrian army, because they're paid by somebody, right? It's about 10,000. Half of all these are foreigners. A lot of Iraqis, they are Saudis, Kuwaitis, you name it. There are even Chechens among the jihadis. Let's say the Syrian Arab army, the official army, the government army, if they manage to clear the major cities within the next 2 or 3 months, and these people, where will they go? They will go to the middle of the desert, the Sunni area. There's nowhere to go. Or they will have to cross the border back to Iraq in the case of many of the jihadi. Another problem, what Patrick said about, let's say, the YouTube question, it's the lost in translation problem, which is essential for a lot of Arabs and for the Iranians as well. This is something I discussed in Iran, in fact, a few years ago. I was trying to convince them, look, you have to do your PR in English. You always have a problem. If you want to sell your story, you have to sell it in English. So, you know, Press TV is their way of doing it, but it's not enough. They have to do it on an everyday basis. And, you know, the Syrian Observatory of Human Rights, with one guy in London, they managed to, you know, infest the planet with YouTube videos, with communiques, you name it. It's more than enough. And you're right. The Baathists, they don't have that.
Yeah, but what they do have is reality on the ground, though, in the country.
They have reality on the ground, exactly. But they
don't have
the
footage to prove it.
The population. You remember when they are pro-regime or pro-Assad demonstrations in Damascus? A few months ago, there was a huge demonstration, 200,000 people in Damascus.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't see it in the New York Times, for instance.
Right.
No,
well, and there were cameras there. Not even the Baathists could screw up that, but the BBC and the Washington Post and the CNN could, yeah.
Exactly.
But now, okay, and so, and this goes to something, and boy, we're running short on time. I'll try to be quick.
Okay.
You mentioned toward the beginning about who all is in what coalition and that kind of thing, and this goes right to that, which is, and I'm going to oversimplify it and get it wrong. You set us all straight to wrap it up here. But basically, you got a 50-50 split in the country. Sunnis on one side, everybody else on the other, all the different kinds of Shiites and Christians and Druze and Kurds and Yazidis and God knows who else, right? And then, and they're all mostly pretty much politically, not individually, but politically, they're all in the bottom. This camp, except for the poorer Sunnis, because the richer Sunnis, the business class ones that you mentioned, they're still part of the governing coalition, and they're apparently not leaving after 2 years of this. So all you have is less than half that even could be the supporters of the revolution, and then, as you said, they've disgusted everyone they're supposedly fighting for with their brutality to the point where they don't even have them. And so, really, the only thing that could prolong it, sounds like, just as a matter of mathematics, looking at it from far away here in Texas anyway, is CIA delivering crates full of guns. But other than that, this thing is doomed to fail soon.
Exactly, and heavy, heavy weapons. This is something that, you know, the only reason why the fragmented opposition, I'm trying to be very benign here, is not going to Geneva, they already said they're not going to Geneva too, is that the only thing that they can say is we want more weapons. They have been saying this for 1 year. And the Americans, for obvious reasons, they are reluctant because they, okay, at least some people remember what happened in Afghanistan in the 1980s. They don't want a replay now in Syria. Only crackpots of the Lindsey Graham variety want more guns for these people.
Right. Yeah, it's the same reason they're not arming the Afghan army right now. They're afraid to give even them anything more than an AK. At least they can learn a lesson. We should congratulate them for that. A lesson learned. One.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Support Al-Qaeda, fine, but don't give them better than an AK-47. All right.
AK-47, replicas, exactly.
Right, yeah. Oh, and sharp swords for beheading their prisoners with.
And swords, exactly. Now, the swords they get from the Saudis, in fact.
Yeah.
So what I was
machetes from
is,
Home Depot.
Don't forget the Saudi-Qatar agenda in all this.
Right. I'm sorry, we're going to have to pick it up there next time around. Thanks.
Next time, man.
Atimes.com, y'all. Pepe Escobar. friends of jihad.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Every month, Plumline Individualist editor Sheldon Richman brings you important news and opinions on policy by heroic FFF President Jacob Hornberger, hard-hitting journalist columnist James Bovard, and others from the best of the libertarian movement. The Future of Freedom tackles the most important issues facing our country, from the bankrupt and insane welfare and regulatory states, to foreign wars and empire, the dismal state of our economy, and ongoing assaults on civil liberties. This society needs peace and freedom for prosperity to prevail. Subscribe to the Future of Freedom in print for just $25 a year, or online for $15 a year at fff.org/subscribe. And hurry up, because this summer they'll be running my articles about the wars in Libya, Syria, and Somalia in the Future of Freedom too. That's fff.org/subscribe for the Future of Freedom. And tell them Scott sent you.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Oh, man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up. Turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner. Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The bill of rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. There for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey, guys, I got his laptop.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Admit it, our public debate has been reduced to reading each other's bumper stickers. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. I made up most of them, and most of those when I was mad as hell about something. So if you hate war, empire, central banking, cops, Republicans, Democrats, gun grabbers, and status of all stripes, go to LibertyStickers.com, and there's a good chance you'll find just what you need for the back of your truck. Own a bookstore? Sell guns at the show? Get the wholesaler's deal. Buy any 100 stickers and they drop down in price to $1 a piece. You can spread the contempt and make a little money too. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.